Welcome back to the Dunked On Basketball podcast, to the chagrin of NBA followers, girlfriends everywhere, the trailing team in all of the series won tonight. Danny, we're going to start with the Brooklyn-Atlanta game. How much of this did you watch, and did you have any preliminary thoughts?
I watched a fair portion of it, and something that I thought about and actually dug into a little bit after you brought up, but I'd been thinking about it independently, was the stagnation of Atlanta's bench. And one of the things that I dug out was that in the regular season, both Dennis Schroeder and Kent Bazemore, who obviously was not their primary backup two guard because they had Tabo, but those two guys both shot better than 35% from three in the regular season. And in the playoffs so far, Schroeder is, I think, below 25% from three, and Bazemore has yet to make one. I believe he's 0 of 12. So that really makes them substantially easier to defend when they're in those lineups.
Yeah, and the Hawks bench units really have struggled. And we've seen really that big runs in these last two games for the Nets have started against those bench units, especially when Schroeder is in, especially when Bazemore is in, and maybe to a lesser extent, Mike Scott. So that's what happened. The Hawks had a nice lead again in the third quarter today and ended up giving it up. Brooklyn went to a really small lineup. Oddly enough, Coach Bud intentionally fouled Mason Plumlee and got him to miss two free throws. So he was taken off the floor. And then they got their butts kicked by that small lineup for the Nets.
Yeah, I guess you could say necessity was mother invention. That's it in that situation.
Yeah. So, I mean, let's a little prefacing for today's whole episode. I'm going to be a little critical of some of these coaches today and their specific moves. And we need to make it clear that coaching isn't just what happens in games. It's about building a culture, keeping the team together throughout the year, player development, fostering communication on defense, building an offensive system, all sorts of stuff like that. So the fact that I'm going to be critical of these coaches is not saying I think they're bad coaches. It's not saying they should be fired. But if they make bad moves in game, and I think a lot of these are pretty objectively bad, at least in my eyes, then I think they deserve to be pointed out.
I completely agree with that, and we'll express the same, you know, we'll express the same sentiment, though obviously we'll have some differing points of emphasis, let's say.
So the number one thing really to talk about in this Brooklyn game, and we're remiss in not getting to it even this long, is Deron Williams' performance.
Yep.
35 points on 25 shots in this game, 7 of 11 on threes. Obviously far superior to what he's been doing really all regular season, all playoffs. Hasn't really had this type of game on a regular basis since end of the 2013 season. What do you make of this performance? Is this just a flash in the pan or something? Maybe has he found something here against the Hawks?
I felt like it was more flash in the pan, but I'm open to that being wrong. You know, he still is a talent. He's a guy who has that. But what I saw in this game didn't seem like something that was obviously repeatable. It is repeatable, but it's not one of those, finding a secret passageway or something like that you can use the rest of the time, or like if you're playing a racing video game where you find the shortcut and then you can use it every time. I didn't see anything like that with him. But he did play very well, and that's encouraging.
Yeah, I actually think D-Will has had pretty good defense in this series. He's had some nice ball denials that has been able to take the Hawks out of their offense on occasion when they try and reverse the ball and get it back into Teague's hands. He's done pretty well on him, I think, overall. But if you look a little more closely into this performance, I mean, 7 of 11 on threes, you're not going to do that every time. He was 13 out of 25 from the field, but only took two free throw attempts, and inside the paint was only 3 of 8. And really, I think other than that hot shooting from 3, not a ton to take away other than that he shot a lot more than normal. And he was able to walk into a lot of threes in transition on the right wing, had a bunch of his makes from there. That's really his favorite spot, shooting threes, is that right wing position. But, yeah, I mean, I don't expect this to sustain. I mean, he may gain some more confidence. He may attack a little bit more. You know, they may put the ball in his hands a little bit more. And he did look more active. You know, he had his crossover game going a little bit more. But the problem with him, and to a lesser extent Rose, is they can get to the basket, but they just can't explode and finish the way they once did. So he had some nice passes too. Great game from him, but in some ways, kind of similar to Austin Rivers, I don't think that we can expect anywhere near this moving forward from him.
Yeah, I definitely agree with that. And beyond the last 30 seconds of regulation, which I'm sure we'll get to, the other takeaway for me was Joe Johnson. And I focused more on his putrid health defense. I think that there were so many circumstances where all he had to do, he didn't have to, you know, make a block shot. I wasn't asking for him to be Serge Ibaka or anything like that. But just getting in the way would have made the shot substantially harder, and a Hawks player would get an open layup or dunk just because he would just watch them 2 feet away.
Yeah, on the tying shot in regulation for the Hawks with about 17 seconds left, the Hawks were able to get a lot of switches. The Nets took Brooke Lopez out and went with Thaddeus Young at center, just to get a bunch of light-sized guys out there so they could switch everything. Millsap was able to actually blow by Bojan Bogdanović from the left wing, and Joe Johnson was standing right under the basket, didn't even move to contest him at all. It was as open a layup as you'll ever see, and that's in a clutch late-game situation after a timeout. Really no excuse for failing to even remotely react guarding someone directly under the basket from him. So that wasn't good. I mean, he shot 5 out of 16, did shoot 5 of 5 from the line. But also, the thing that I noticed, too, is when the Nets made their comeback, the ball was moving a lot more than it normally was. And either the ball was moving, or at least the player with the ball was moving. A lot of that was D-Will able to get some penetration and find people, or at least get the rotation started. And as soon as Joe Johnson comes back in, he just holds the ball, and he pounds the ball. He doesn't even really go anywhere when he pounds the ball. And he took a lot away from what had been successful for them when he was out of the game in that late third quarter, early fourth quarter.
And the Nets are in a really tough situation because even if they agree with that, his contract is so hard to move that you probably just have to deal with it.
Yeah, I mean, they did reduce his role this year. He was down to about a 20% usage rate this year now, and I think that's good. They just, and I don't know if necessarily the current coach is the one who's going to impress us upon him, but I think he needs to go back to more of a role of what he played very early in his career in Phoenix, where he's going to be a good shooter in the right matchup. Maybe he can isolate on occasion, but he needs to just make faster decisions. He needs to either shoot the ball when he's open, he's still a good shooter, or move the ball quickly or drive immediately instead of just pounding and pounding and, you know, let's see what happens off of that. But that's somewhat ancillary to the point here. How did you feel about the Hawks' performance overall?
I didn't think that they did a great job, but when you look at some of the peripherals and you look at everything, it's one of those games that you see it and you're like, and you kind of wonder for a second why they lost, except that when you watched the game, it was more apparent. And so you'd see things like, I believe they won the offensive rebounding, threes were pretty close, and you look at things like that, but I believe turnovers and points off turnovers was a big swing point. But I didn't think they played particularly well. Some of that is due to their bench, but they're not inspiring a lot of confidence. I don't think it's that they're getting beat, though I do think the Nets are doing a good job. It's that they aren't rising to the level they were at in the regular season.
Their offense was much better today. I did note the offensive rebounding. That's not something you see from them very often. They, in, you know, with Budenholzer being from the Spurs tree, they punt on the offensive glass a lot. But Damari Carroll had 7 offensive rebounds. He was a monster in this game.
He was.
5 assists, 20 points on 15 shooting possessions, and really had some outstanding help defense as well. I mean, there was one play right at the end as the Hawks were trying to come back at the end of regulation where he managed to, Brook Lopez got the ball at the dotted line on a roll. Carroll managed to step in front of him, make him pick up his dribble, block his first pass attempt to the wing to Joe Johnson, who Carroll was guarding. Then Lopez succeeded in making the pass, and Carroll got all the way out to the three-point line, closed out on him and forced Johnson to drive and miss a tough runner. I mean, it's rare that I can ever recall seeing someone cover that much ground so quickly. And that's why, you know, in addition to the fact that he can make some threes and make some hustle plays, that's why he's going to get paid this offseason.
Yeah, he's such a versatile player, and he provides value in a lot of areas without really taking it away, which I think is something you're looking for in that type of a player. And, yeah, I think he's a great fit on this team, and I think he'd be a good fit on a lot of other quality teams, as long as you have somebody else who can be the go-to scorer and somebody else who can run the offense.
So we mentioned the tying play by Millsap at close to the end of regulation. Then the Hawks had a foul to give. So Lionel Hollins told Deron Williams to go early because of that. And what he said in the post-game presser was that the plan was for Deron to attack and make them give the foul early, and if they didn't, then to pull it out. But then he said that Deron thought he had a good look and took it, and he was fine with it. The problem was there was still 6 seconds left. The Nets were able to D up and force overtime anyway. What do you think? Was that a good decision by D-Will, or would you have had him pull it back out again?
Oh, I would like
that look he had.
I mean, the look was all right, but you're guaranteeing the other team is going to get a chance, because when you shoot it with 10 seconds left, they're going to get it with, assuming you don't get the offensive rebound, they're going to get it with 6 seconds left. You can do a lot in 6 seconds. I think that you pull it out because in that circumstance, with that much time left, you're not giving yourself a guaranteed look. That wasn't by any means, you know, a great shot. It was a good shot. It was a clean shot.
Yeah, he was about 10 feet on the baseline, kind of turning around a little bit. I mean, that's probably, you know, your epitome of a 40% shot, basically.
Yeah, exactly. So you don't give up a guaranteed worst-case scenario of overtime for that shot. If it's a dunk, yeah, maybe. Maybe you do something like that. But not in that circumstance. And it was surprising because it just seemed so unaware. Like, I get that he said afterwards he thought it was a good look, but it was kind of like, to me, it looked like, hey, I'm open, I'm going to shoot it, to me, as opposed to that step in that process. But obviously that's looking at it as a bystander, not being on the court.
Yeah, I mean, it was an interesting tete-a-tete with, is it tete-a-tete or tete-a-tete?
Tete-a-tete. Awesome. I have a French last name.
Learn something new every day.
Yep.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, your dad's French-Canadian, right?
Yes,
so you would know that.
Yes, sir. I took it in school.
So an interesting tete-a-tete with the whole, you know, when is Budenholzer going to use the foul to give, you know, go early and make him take it sort of thing. So I guess the instruction was to just not take it, and that paid off in that instance. One thing that I think did not pay off for Coach Bud, however, was his treatment of Al Horford. Now, he did have to go back to the starters pretty early on in the fourth quarter, which he generally doesn't like to do because, as we mentioned, the Nets were making their run, and that did stanch the bleeding a bit. But then Horford got, I think, his fifth foul about midway through the quarter, and Coach Bud took him out and didn't bring him back until there was 1 minute remaining. And he didn't really have much of an explanation for it other than just that it was foul trouble. I've never, ever seen a coach wait that long to bring a guy back. You know, part of that might have been rest, and a lot of times he'll leave Antetokounmpo pretty late and come back with him at the under three timeout. But bringing him back with 1 minute left, I mean, that's just like the epitome of basically enforcing the effect of fouling out on your own team. You're guaranteeing that he's going to miss time instead of taking the risk that he might miss time. Then, even worse, he had him sit out, I think, for at least the first 3 minutes, maybe even more, of the overtime for the same reason. It was relatively inexplicable in my eyes.
I completely agree, and I think the way that you phrased it is good, that you're basically taking the punishment before you have to take the punishment, because you never know if a guy's going to be able to play with it. And with the structure of the game, particularly in the fourth quarter, though the overtime was egregious itself, is that him not being on the floor made it easier for the Nets to get in position to either tie or win the game in regulation. And you don't, when you're in that situation to go 3-1, if you take the best case scenario and the worst case scenario there, you don't weaken yourself just for the possibility that you might be have a rough final couple minutes, because they had a chance, from what I felt, they had a chance with about 3-4 minutes left to really get a better seal on the game.
Yeah, and the Nets, in both the times that he was out, really had some nice buckets in the paint that he may have been able to deter a little better than Perontich did.
Yeah. Another thing with this game, we talked about the strange decision from the Nets at the end of regulation. The Hawks also, what might have been more of an execution issue than anything else, they didn't even get a shot off in that aforementioned 6 seconds after they got the offensive rebound and called a timeout. They didn't even get a shot up, and I always am frustrated when that happens. It happened in the NCAA tournament a bunch, and it happens in the pros sometimes too, because it wasn't even like it was really that close. I think Millsap eventually broke through and shot it like a full second after the clock expired, and I always get mad at that.
A couple other small notes here. I mean, I think, you know, he kind of fumbled it, and that happens. I mean, yeah. I'm never like, oh my God, I can't believe you didn't get a shot off. Like, the players know, they're trying. It's just, you know, sometimes the other team plays good defense. I think that's what happened in this instance. But a couple more things. Hollins, after the Hawks tied it in regulations, he took a timeout, advanced the ball, even though there were only 16 seconds left. I think part of that was to impart that instruction about when to go and the foul to give and stuff. But that timeout also allowed the Hawks to put Kent Bazemore in that same lineup that was out there to close game two with no point guard. And Bazemore was on D-Will and may have given him a little more trouble on that tying shot than Jeff Teague would have. So that, to me, is a very good reason why you generally want to go with no timeout if you can avoid it, because you let the other team get their defense set. And I think whatever reminders you're going to give your team, I think that the reminders on defense are sometimes more useful, where it's, you know, don't foul. If it's, hey, make sure they don't get a three here. If it's, you know, this is how we're going to, these are all their plays. Let's remind them about how we're going to defend all these specific actions. And we know what they like to run late game. I think actually timeouts are a greater benefit for the defense. And some research that I did a couple years ago shows that your e-field goal percentage after a timeout is basically lower than any other situation, including after a make or just a regular out of bounds.
Yep. Did you have another observation? I think you said you had two.
Yeah, but I just figured I shouldn't talk for so long.
Oh, I didn't really have anything to add. I agree with all that. So
the second observation I have is, you know, a lot of people love to lambaste Deron Williams. They like to lambaste Derrick Rose. Oh, they're so inconsistent. You know, like it's somehow, oh, he's just not focused this game. I mean, I think the simplest explanation in these is often the best, and that is that these guys have struggled with health problems. And you have days where you feel good, where your knees are feeling good, your ankles in the case of D-Will, and you feel like a million bucks out there. And then at other times, especially depending on if you haven't had a ton of rest or you've played a ton of minutes, maybe, you know, you don't play as well. So I think that's, especially with guys who have had injuries, the health is a big reason why you can't be as consistent as you might have been earlier in your career.
And the timing for Kevin Pelton wrote an article talking about the splits with Derrick Rose in terms of his rest, and it was a very good piece, and then it ended up flowing into our next game, which was Chicago trying to close out the series against Milwaukee.
Yeah, so what KP's article said was basically 0 or 1 days of rest, Rose shoots about like Kirk Heinrich, and I just keep saying Heinrich. Kirk Heinrich.
Yes.
And then when he has 2 or more days of rest, he shoots more like Goran Dragic. So it's a pretty stark difference, and we've seen that in games 1 of 3 when he had the rest. He was awesome in the series, and he's been bad in the games where he only had 1 day of rest. So that obviously was an issue. Rose was really bad today. Both defensively and really in pretty much every aspect of the game other than just with his awesome cross-court passes, which he doesn't get enough credit for. But now we got to get into really a lot of ways and why this was disappointing for the Bulls, and I would say a lot of that was because of some of the coaching moves or lack thereof by Tom Thibodeau.
Yeah, and so those go in a couple different directions, but something that you and I have talked about a series of times already on this very young podcast is the idea of a team's best five and the idea of fitting guys together. And you and I have been talking about the Bulls. I mean, we know each other far outside of this podcast about the idea of how the Bulls' big men fit together. And it has been a major point of frustration that Nikola Mirotic not only hasn't been playing with the right players, but has spent so much time playing small forward, which negates so many of his advantages.
Yeah, I do think that maybe it might be a little more defensible how little he was playing, except, you know, it's not really any different from how Tibbs has used him most of the year when all four big men are healthy. But he really only played the last 8 minutes or so of each half at the four. But then, of course, the Bulls usually played pretty well with that, especially offensively. He definitely is not right now with that that contusion and that swollen knee that he suffered in game two with the collision with O.J. Mayo. He's usually very, very active, sprinting the floor, and he's kind of running with a limp right now. He's definitely not quite all the way there, not able to have the effect that he normally does driving to the basket against slower players. But he's still just simply the threat of his spacing is able to open things up for everyone. And even Noah was able to get some nice buckets with Mirotic at the four early in the fourth quarter. But, you know, Coach Tibbs wasted a lot of time, 6 minutes at the start of each half, if not more, with Gasol and Noah, and the Bulls really struggled to score very severely in those minutes due to the lack of spacing. Rose is someone who really struggles when both of those guys there, and so does Butler. They can't get to the rim because there's two guys in the way, and they're just helping off of them very liberally.
Yeah, I agree with all that. One thing that I've been thinking about with this series, and it was something I thought last year too, is I've been so impressed with Jason Kidd. I think he's done a really good job, and I think considering I believe that Milwaukee has substantially less talent right now than the Bulls do.
Oh, you think?
That they've been able to do this. But one of the things that I carried tonight was I'm just excited to see what he can do if they can have anything close to a full health roster, and they should be able to add a piece either through the draft or, you know, another way because of the way their flexibility is. So I'm really excited to see where this team is going to go, particularly as a playoff team, once they have more offensive talent.
Yeah, you know, it'll be good to see what they can do with Jabari back next year, but this series is far from over. I mean, Milwaukee is probably going to be favored at home in Game 6. At least they will be to me. And maybe we're going to a Game 7, which would be definitely a sphincter-tightening time for the Bulls and their fans. A couple more notes on Coach Thibodeau, and we also should get to who played well for the Bucks too. I'm a little more focused on the Bulls just due to my Chicago heritage. But Jimmy Butler, he played, let's see, where is that? Looking at the second half box score. Jimmy Butler, 24 minutes played in the second half. Derrick Rose, 23 minutes, 22 seconds in the second half. Tony Snell, 19 minutes, 54 seconds, all of which were played consecutively after he replaced Mike Dunleavy with 4 minutes left, or 4 minutes gone in the third. Mm-hmm. So really, pretty remarkable, and that's something that Tibbs is well known for too, is bringing in a reserve. He used to do this with Taj Gibson all the time, and just playing him a ton of minutes in a row. And it's not even your minutes total so much as it is playing a ton of minutes and not quite getting enough time to recover. Recovery time is huge. So Taj Gibson only played 8 minutes in this game. I really would like to see him get some more time at center in lieu of Noah, especially against a Milwaukee team when they go to John Henson. Taj Gibson would be a nice matchup at center with as someone who can actually finish inside, post up a little bit, and also a little more mobile than this version of Joakim Noah. You know, but Gibson played exclusively at power forward. And it really was just it was some rough player usage from the Bulls, and if they had distributed the minutes a little bit better, gotten guys a little more rest, they might not have wilted down the stretch the way they did.
And Michael Carter-Williams put up a really good stat line. He had 22 points on 15 shots, 8 rebounds, 9 assists. And one of the things I carried, obviously he did a great job, was also that he was abusing Derrick Rose from what I could see. And that's an important part of this, but you were talking about the dynamic of the series and the favorite. And one of the important things that we have to think about moving forward is that the next game of the series isn't until Thursday, which is a really long time, and very fortunate for Chicago.
fortunate in some respects, but unfortunate now that their series against Cleveland can't start until Monday. Why don't we get into that news a little bit?
That's a good point.
Kevin Love declared out for the entire Bulls series now, so maybe it actually, if that really does come to pass, it doesn't matter that much that the Bulls are forced to play another game, other than the fact that Mirotić is not going to get as much time to recover and Rose isn't going to get as much time to recover. But it was surprising to a lot of people that Love was ruled out that fast. There was a report that he was going to get another opinion on it as well, and I don't know if that had actually happened at the time that report came out mid-afternoon. This could be the sort of thing where, like with Serge Ibaka last year, where it's easier to just rule him out and then, you know, kind of under promise and over deliver if he comes back earlier, rather than, especially for someone who is a little bit checkered in the eyes of the media, and a lightning rod for criticism for whatever reason, to have him sort of be projected to come back earlier and then not meet that timetable, would look bad. So it's much easier to just roll it back if it turns out that he can come back earlier. But I mean, based on a lot of what I've been reading, and it sounded like this is a relatively severe shoulder dislocation, that's missing that whole series is not at all unrealistic.
Yeah, and something that I wanted to note is that this isn't like baseball where you have to have a playoff roster, and if you don't have that guy on there, then that has bigger ramifications. In this circumstance, the Cavs are under no obligation when they say something like that. It has no weight. You know, it has the weight that they said it, but it doesn't constrain them at all. They can bring him back for game one if he were theoretically healthy. It doesn't do anything like that. So it takes the media off their back, but it doesn't bind their hands at all. But it is important because it gives some sort of calibration of how long he's going to be out. And as you and I talked about yesterday, he is a major determining factor in the next series, regardless of who they play, but especially if they play Chicago.
Actually, let me correct one error, too. Taj Gibson played 15 minutes. I was only looking at the second half box score there, but you know, still someone I would have liked to see get more time at the expense of Noah when the Bucks don't really have a big center who's going to take advantage of it. Noah played 32 minutes. He was a little better in this game. 9 offensive rebounds, although a lot of those were kind of fruitless taps around on the offensive glass. But his help defense was strangely lacking in this game, and that was a big part of why Carter Williams was able to take advantage of Rose. He had 10 field goals, all of which were in the paint, and a lot of those were kind of backing down Rose, shooting a floater, or it was, you know, him being able to blow past and have there not be any help there. I mean, this Bucks team doesn't have so much shooting that they should be able to just, go right to the rim against the Bulls. I mean, the Bucks didn't shoot amazingly well for the game, but they still put up 92 points, and this is not a team with a ton of firepower that they should be able to outscore the Bulls if the Bulls are playing the type of defense they should be.
Agreed, and while we were talking about the potential next round series, the other big note in that series is that J.R. Smith was suspended 2 games by the league, so those games would be the first 2 games of their next series, regardless of opponent. Also, Kelly Olynyk was suspended for 1 game, though that will, of course, come next season.
What do you think of those suspensions?
I actually thought it was on the lenient side for J.R. Smith, considering his history. I would have been completely fine with them going as far as 4 or 5 games. I was thinking more in the 3 to 4 realm myself, but it's one of those things where you think about where you would do it and where you would be frustrated by it. Olynyk getting a game is interesting, I think. I think that's actually one of the times we use the word interesting a lot, but it's a time that I think that is really appropriate. You and I both expressed a little bit of discomfort with the way that injury happened, which appears to be somewhat unusual on basketball Twitter. For me, it was the use of the second hand. And a game I think that's fine. You know, it's a little bit strange to suspend a guy for the beginning of next season. And it's so far away right now, but I think it's a fine punishment, and it's not so disproportionate that, oh, they did it just because he got really hurt. It's a single game.
Yeah, but I mean, I think that's a little bit more than the situation I have analogized to several times is that Dwayne Wade play back in 2011 against Boston, which he did not get suspended for, where he dislocated Rajon Rondo's elbow. So maybe this is more moving towards player safety and just telling guys don't be quite as reckless. JR, I think there is maybe an understanding that a playoff game is more important than a regular season game. Yeah. I thought that what he did was pretty much as egregious as the Ron Artest elbow on James Harden a couple of years ago when Harden was still on the Thunder. But that was regular season, so that suspension, I think, was mostly, if not all, regular season games. So two games, I mean, I think anything less than that I would have been disappointed in, but more than that would have been getting up to where it's like, all right, you know, now you're really, really ruining his ability to contribute in the series at all. So it seems about fair to me.
And we're going to get to see a heavy dose of Iman Shumpert on Kyrie Irving now. It seems like that's going to come early on. On Derrick Rose. Sorry, I crossed it up. Because Black's not going to have a whole ton of other options. So I think that we're going to see it early. And I think that's a good thing for the Cavs as they move throughout the series. Obviously, not having J.R. Smith is bad. But to have that understanding. And I think they might end up starting Shumpert for the entirety of the series.
Another news item before we get into Memphis-Portland. Chandler Parsons might have to have microfracture. He's now, consulted with two doctors. It's actually three. I think the Mavs, Rockets, and Bulls physicians. He's consulted with all of them. They're not sure whether he's going to have microfracture until they go in and look at it. They might be able to just kind of trim the cartilage and fix things that way. But definitely really disappointing for him. And we talked to very early on in this podcast about the way that injury was managed, where he missed time. Then he came back, played over 30 minutes in that first game against Houston. And he admitted afterwards that the reason he tried to play was because it was Houston, his former team, where there'd kind of been some smack talking back and forth. And, you know, among those two franchises for really the last 5 years or so. And then, you know, now he might have to have microfracture. Well, you know, did he need the microfracture before he tried to play 30 minutes on what was a bad wheel against Houston? You know, I guess we'll never know that, but it's definitely not something that looks real great, to be honest.
Yeah, and do you have a better sense of how long the recovery on that could be?
For microfracture, typically, I think it can go as much as 8 months. I mean, you never really know with that, too. I think a lot of it matters how large the affected area is and that sort of stuff. I mean, Amari Stoudemire theoretically came back in like 4 or 5 months. Some guys, I think, have come back that quickly, although Stoudemire later had to shut it down. But that was also 9 years ago. I mean, there's certainly been speculation that it could even leach into training camp for him next year. And what's worse, I mean, that's not a surgery that people really come back from 100%. And we haven't heard of people getting microfracture that much recently.
Yeah, it's one of those. It kind of feels in some ways like a relic now. I mean, I remember the horror when I heard Greg Oden had to have it the first time and all that. But now it seems like, you know, with the movement to other procedures and everything, it's kind of like, oh, yeah, that's right. That's still out there. So, yeah, I think we can move into the last game of the night. I actually spent most of the game a little bit depressed just because it felt like it was going in a different direction. And, you know, Portland had such a fabulous season that I kind of started doing what Barry started doing during the Brent Barry started doing during the game, which is kind of in a way eulogizing it. And then Portland came back. But for me, the major story of this game, which is not a major story for me most of the time, was point guard defense. And Mike Conley is one of the more underappreciated players in the league for me, and a big part of the reason why that happens is because he's a very good defender. And what we saw from Damian Lillard tonight was that he was able to get to places on the floor that he's more comfortable doing, that he gets to more often, and being guarded by Nick Kolathis and Beno Udrih for the most part, though he did have Tony Allen on him at points, and Courtney Lee, I believe, for stretches as well. We got to see more of that with Lillard, and we got to see how that affected the Portland offense. And at the same time, Lillard's defense is really, really, really bad. And we saw Nikolathis make more threes than I believe he had ever made in his career. Congratulations to Nikolathis. And there were a lot of issues with not necessarily blown rotations, but just blown assignments and things like that. And Damian Lillard is a wonderful player. I like him a lot. But that is a major flaw of his game that I believe needs to be corrected for him to take that next leap into being a really important player on a truly great team, though I don't think the Blazers had that chance this year, considering their injuries anyway.
Yeah, it's definitely pretty rough for him. There had been talk that he had improved early on in the year, and overall their defense was a lot better. I think part of that was because he was able to hide, and they would had Matthews and they had Batum. Now that he's actually had to guard point guards every once in a while, even someone as relatively non-threatening as Calathes, he just hasn't been able to even provide token resistance. A few things that stood out to me, pretty much every portion of the possession, even sometimes when his man had the ball, he would either be standing straight up or hands on his knees even. And with Calathes not known as a great shooter, although he was able to hit some shots, Lillard was going under the screen, and this I only saw really the fourth quarter, but was going under the screen and still wasn't able to beat Calathes to the spot, and Calathes was getting right on in. He missed a couple of layups, which Portland was very fortunate for. So that was one observation. I mean, I think when I rated Lillard at number 10, although in a tier with a bunch of other guys, so it was very close, I think I was guilty of not taking how bad his defense is into account. And at the time I wrote that, we hadn't had that much time to see Portland without Matthews yet. And so it's been pretty ugly since then without Matthews and Batum both in there to kind of hide him. Also, some interesting ramifications developing in the series for free agency. One is that Robin Lopez has had his second straight really disappointing playoffs. I only saw the end. He wasn't closing. His stats overall have been bad. I assume he started. Why didn't he end up closing, you think, in this game?
Well, he got outplayed by Myers Leonard. I mean, not only did Myers Leonard have a pretty solid game, especially on his curve, and I like Myers, but Lopez, he wasn't impacting the game as much as you wanted. And it was funny considering that a lot of times in the later part of the game, Marc Gasol was posting up Myers Leonard and abusing him in certain stretches, that they still didn't make that switch. But Lopez, he wasn't powering them on the offensive boards like he can do at times, even when he's not really getting a ton of shots, he can do that. And I didn't notice any particular positives with his defense. I admittedly wasn't watching the beginning of the game as closely as I watched some other things, but I didn't see him as a substantial positive in any way out there, and that's a really big problem when you're facing a Memphis team that is always going to have a positive from that position.
6 points for Lopez on 4 shots, minus 17. Myers Leonard, 13 points on 6 shots, 3 of 3 from behind the 3-point line. And he even was able to create a lot of nice offense for the Blazers because Gasol was guarding him. There was one instance pretty late in the game where C.J. McCollum was able to just drive right to the basket in semi-transition because Leonard was spaced out in the strong side corner and Gasol just wouldn't leave him. He was pretty much on the block and just wouldn't even contest C.J. McCollum, who was able to drive right in and not a great finisher, but was able to there due to the lack of resistance. So I think offensively they found something. And Lopez, he's probably much better at protecting the basket than Leonard is, but Memphis doesn't do a ton of actually driving, especially without Conley. So, and Lopez is a pretty bad post defender. Leonard is no great shakes either, but, you know, we've seen Lopez get kind of beaten up by Gasol in the post and then Dwight Howard last year. So you might as well bring in Leonard and space the floor and force guys like Gasol and Randolph to get all the way out to the 3-point line, and he's been hitting his shot. So the question now is, Lopez is one of the great bargains in the league at $5 million. New Orleans regrets getting rid of him in that Tyreke Evans deal a couple of years ago. But Leonard is going to be extension eligible. Are you going to move on from Lopez? He's probably going to demand an 8-figure salary. Do you let him go, stick with Leonard, and then try to bring in some more, a little more versatile front court depth, someone who can play the 4 and the 5? That's a good question, but it hasn't been an encouraging series for Lopez's free agency.
Yeah, it really hasn't been, and it's hard when you're in that realm with centers of, you know, if you're not a clear positive, and, you know, if you're not that, and we talk about the idea of a guy being a value and that changing around a lot. And with him, you're starting to reach the area where you worry that he's going to be maybe not overpaid, but that he'll be overslotted in terms of his role. And that's a challenge. You know, Omar Asik's probably going to be dealing with a similar issue, incidentally, considering he's the guy that New Orleans ended up getting.
There's a ton of centers this year, too. I mean, that's going to be real interesting to see how those musical chairs shake out. I would expect we might see some situation where teams just, like, trade centers even. We might even see that, because there's really almost 15 good centers who are available on the market this year. So
and there's another one in the series, Costa Kufos, who
he's another guy who, I mean, is he really any worse than Lopez? I guess Lopez can shoot, but Kufos is a little stouter. But Kufos could maybe even be kind of a lower end starter as well. You make a good point there.
I think he could be a logical fit in Portland, actually.
Well, I think they really need a guy who isn't a center, someone who can swing between the four and the five, and just, you know, usually if you're a four, you can play the five off the bench, because then they want someone who can play with both whoever the starting center is and Aldridge and have a three-man big-man rotation. So I think that's been a problem, that they basically have three centers and then no backup power forwards this year.
Yeah, and that's the defensive issue with Myers-Leonard, is he's in that realm of guys who, you and I have talked about this before, where it's, you know, if they can't really be a rim protector, but they can't really defend fours. And so that's a challenging thing. Myers-Leonard has the offensive value, but that makes him a challenging guy to find a fit with, assuming that you want rim protection, which everybody does right now.
Yeah, but I mean, I think giving both Leonard and Lopez a big contract might be a non-starter for them. Okay. But you know, we'll see how things finish out in this series, and you know, how the center market ends up shaking out. But that'll be something to monitor in the closing days or in the coming days. What else you got? Anything else?
Yeah, one other thing that I wanted to spend a little bit of time on is, to me, is one of the stories of this postseason, which will continue into the second round, is the importance of shooting, particularly from non-traditional positions. And it's something that we've seen that it has an impact on the game in ways that are sometimes hard to see. And you talked about it with the CJ McCollum drive that was facilitated by Myers-Leonard being on the floor. And what you see when you get that is that it affects the way that a defense is shaped, and it affects the way that players affect one another. It affects the way that they defend and the way that what they're used to in terms of help and everything. And I think that we're going to see that have an outsized level of importance later on in the playoffs, and it's been exciting to see so far.
Yeah, I mean, if you think about it, how many of the league's best offenses play two big guys, neither of whom are at least good jump shooters, if not actually three-point shooters? Not that many, right? I mean, the Spurs, you could say Duncan and Splitter together. Memphis, you know, is like kind of hovers around the top 10, but no one would say that they're a great offense necessarily. So, and aside from that,
The Clippers.
Yeah, the Clippers would be another one, and they're, you know, they at least have guys who are really athletic and great dunkers, and they're able to use the passing of Blake Griffin. And that's actually one thing that Jazz broadcaster David Locke harps on a lot, is that if you don't have guys who can space at the big positions, you better have guys who are great passers, or you're not going to be able to make that work. And it's Blake's passing that's a big part of that. So, yeah, I mean, you're right. Shooting is really important, and if you don't have that shooting, you're more likely than not going to be a very good offense if you're just got two guys down there clogging up space.
And the other dynamic with it, which I think is going to become more prevalent in the league, is seeing it from backup lineups. Because when you're dealing with defenders, oftentimes, because you often see backups against backups, that they won't have had that much experience defending in space. So if you can have a stretch four, and most teams don't have a true rim protector as their backup center, so you can exploit that, so you create more space for guys who are probably more flawed, perfect for a guy like CJ McCollum in that sense, that you can create more space for them to operate, which allows you to have a more functional offense during that time. And especially if it's coming from the power forward position, you can still be somewhat traditional at the five if you want to be, or you can go further out like some of the Warriors bench units have done, which I think has worked incredibly well.
You know, you look at, for example, like a great example is Draymond Green and David Lee for the Warriors, right? You know, obviously their defense is much better with Green. That's clear. But I think most people would say there's no way Draymond Green is a better offensive player than David Lee. David Lee is a tremendously skilled guy, ambidextrous around the basket, can great in the pick and roll, good passer, and all that. But simply the fact that Green can shoot threes and Lee can't opens up so much for everyone else. That I think it makes them better on offense when Green is out there than when Lee is, not to mention the defense. That's just a perfect example where Green is not as skilled as Lee, but simply the fact that he can shoot it opens the floor. And as you said, those small guys, Curry, Thompson, those guys are good finishers, but they're not amazingly athletic guys, but they have a lot more space because they're playing with a guy who can shoot the ball at the four.
Yeah, and I'm excited to see how Houston manages everything because they have, I mean, with Monte Yunus out this year, that's a little bit unfortunate, but if Terrence Jones has enough confidence to keep shooting his shot when he has it, and Josh Smith every once in a while, he has his three things, though that's, of course, a different discussion. But I'm excited to see what they can do considering they're another team that needs a lot of space, and it also affects how they manage their lineups in terms of Patrick Beverley and everything else. But I think it's going to be something that grows in the league, especially as young guys, you know, 16, 17-year-olds, see that there's a space for that in the league and can work on that as a skill that is rewarded as opposed to a skill that is nice but not really that appreciated.
Yeah, because, you know, certainly when I was growing up, you know, everyone was saying, hey, you know, you got to be a big guy, you got to post up. Lamenting the trend of big guys developing perimeter skills, but I think ultimately it's turned out that that's actually creates more efficient offense than pounding the ball into the post does. All right, well, so we've probably gone on too long with that digression. so we will leave you for now. You can subscribe on iTunes. If you want to give us a rating, that would be great. That helps us keep things going. Hopefully get some more listeners, and we'll see you next time tomorrow night. Till then.